here's what he done. He hit the ball in the back, and the bat in the ball. You should have heard them fans all squall. It's going, this time it's really gone. Say the baseball boogie when Jackie comes running home. One ball, one strike, one out, one run. Jackie at the bat, here's what he done. Say the ball hit the bat, the bat hit the ball. You should have heard them fans all squall. It's going, this time it's really gone. Say the baseball boogie when Jackie comes.
Radio Free Brooklyn, and this is Reciprocity Radio. This is a show about food, cooking, eating, drinking, everything on your table, recipes, all of that stuff. Sorry for a late start today. I was driving over and hit some bad traffic, but I'm here now, and I started the show with Baseball Boogie, which was sung by Nina Simone, and then after that, Love is Like a Baseball Game. Intruders, and now in the background you're hearing Vince Guaraldi Trio playing Baseball Theme. I'm pretty sure you can guess what the theme of today's show is. It's baseball. It was opening day this past Thursday, and I was extremely excited, and I've been deeply relieved and happy to be back watching the Mets play, and I don't know, something about baseball is just, it's very magical, and the season lasts very long, and it's one of the happiest times of year for me because it means that spring's finally here and I will have this whole long summer to go to Mets, to City Field, and eat ice cream out of a helmet and watch fireworks and drink beer with my friends. Really excited. So it's a pretty easy tell. I think that there's a huge connection between baseball and food, whether that's beer or hot dogs or gum and baseball cards or all of the crazy things that you can get at the various stadiums around the country. So I'm going to talk about that today, the connection between food and baseball, and just some fun baseball stuff in general. I hope you're having a lovely Sunday. It was sort of stopped raining and was like blue on one side of the sky on the way here and then really dark on the other, so it's sort of pretty intense. Yeah, so I've got some really fun clips today. Lots of interesting history tidbits and some fun music to play. One of my favorite things I think I'll play now is this clip of Vince Scully reading a grocery list, which seems appropriate for the show. I don't know why they asked him to do it. I think it was because he just sounds so good reading anything that reading a grocery list for him was sort of like epic or poetic in a way. If you don't know who Vince Scully is, he was the announcer for the Brooklyn Dodgers that then became the Los Angeles Dodgers, and I think he only retired about 2 years ago. So we're going to hear that right now. And then I'll go into some facts about the history of baseball and food. Thanks for tuning in.
Sure, Andy, I'd be happy to. Well, let's see. We've got a dozen eggs, a quart of milk, a loaf of bread, a can of frozen orange juice, 6 small white onions, a green pepper, garlic powder, a package of American cheese, pickles, kosher that is, bananas, cornflakes, maple syrup, toothpaste, paper towels, toilet paper, 6 bars of soap, hot dogs, quarter pound of chopped meat, steak, lamb chops, package of spaghetti, 3 apples, bologna, cottage cheese, a pound of butter, 2 ears of corn, beer, ketchup, peanut butter, soy sauce, and a half a pound of coffee.
All right, so that was Vin Scully reading a grocery list. I found that to be delightful. Yeah, so let's talk about the history of baseball and food. This is from the History.com History Channel. And there's a lot of things. There's even the song, Take Me Out to the Ball Game, like Buy Me Some Peanuts and Cracker Jacks. Those are big things. I remember when I was younger, going to my brother's games and always getting like those big pieces of gum that were kind of disgustingly sweet and wrapped in like yellow and blue paper. Those were huge. And like Big League Chew was a very big deal when I was younger. I don't know if you know what that is, but it's gum that's like all torn up in a little pouch. It's supposed to sort of resemble chewing tobacco, which is also sold in pouches. So it was a very like sort of strange thing that you could get as a kid, which you would chew it like baseball players used to chew chewing tobacco. But it was really fun to eat because it came in different flavors and like little shreds, so that was always fun. But I still have a very distinct memory of like the powdery, gross like sort of texture that's around the gum and how it could be so dry. And I don't know, my sugar intake has certainly changed since I was a kid, but I still love hot dogs and I still love beer, so let's talk about that. With baseball season back in full swing, we take a look at classic ballpark snacks like hot dogs, peanuts, and the Cracker Jack. Hot dogs are the world's first sausage, may have been made as far back as 64 AD, when Emperor Nero Claudius Caesar's cook, Gaius, stuffed pig intestines with ground meat in a flash of culinary inspiration. After eating the sausage, the emperor is said to have declared, "I have discovered something of great importance." If your favorite ballpark treat is a fresh hot dog overflowing with ketchup, mustard, and sauerkraut, you just might concur. In the 15th century, the city of Frankfurt spawned the Frankfurter, a spiced and smoked sausage with a slightly curved shape. The Wiener, a sausage made of pork and beef, originated in Vienna and is known in German as Wien. And in 1805. Throughout the 19th century, the snack would soon become the hot dog gained a following in America thanks to immigrants from Europe. So what distinguishes a hot dog from a Frankenfurter or a Wiener? That's where the bun comes in. And it's the exact origins are up for debate, as are so many things on this show about food history. Many hot dog historians credit Antonin Fechtwagner, a St. Louis peddler who offered his customers white gloves along with their piping hot sausages to keep them from burning their hands. The problem was that many people walked off with the gloves rather than returning them. So Fechtwanger profits, his profits suffered. Around 1883, the cash-strapped concessionaire's wife came up with an ingenious solution, a long, soft roll that perfectly fits the sausage. Fechtwanger dubbed the meat bread combo Red Hots, which I think is still a thing. I know in Vermont you can buy Red Hots hot dogs, and they are red. I've never eaten one for that reason. And others point to Charles Feldman, a German butcher who in 1867 began selling hot sausages on rolls out of the pie wagon he hauled up and down the sand dunes of Brooklyn's Coney Island. And with a few years, he expanded his business from a lowly pushcart into a hot dog empire with an immense restaurant, a beer garden, and multiple stands. Business was booming until Nathan Handwerker, a bread slicer at Feldman's, broke away to open his own stand in 1916. He undercut his former boss, charging half prices for the dog, about 5 cents instead of 10. Today, Nathan's famous hot dogs are sold in more than 20,000 food service and retail outlets across the United States. Since 1916, the original Coney Island location has held an annual hot dog eating contest on July 4th, and the current record stands at 68 dogs in 10 minutes. That is very gross. did you know Babe Ruth once devoured a dozen hot dogs and 8 bottles of soda between games of a doubleheader? Americans put away 7 billion hot dogs during peak season between Memorial Day and Labor Day. 10% of the annual retail hot dog sales occurred during July, as known also as National Hot Dog Month. And in 2008, Los Angeles and New York spent more on hot dogs than any other cities in the United States, which would be 90 million and 108 million, respectively. A regular hot dog is 250 calories, including the bun, ketchup, mustard, relish, and sauerkraut, and other common toppings. So I don't know if you've ever traveled around to different baseball stadiums. I have limited experience in this, but I did get the pleasure years ago of going to the Cubs Stadium, which is really beautiful, probably my favorite that I've visited. And it made me think of a Chicago-style hot dog, which I wanted to talk about very quickly, because if you've ever seen one, it comes with a lot of extra toppings, where I think as New York, it's generally like a ketchup and mustard thing, and that's it. Chicago-style hot dog is an all-beef frankfurter on a poppy seed bun, and it originates from Chicago, Illinois. The hot dog is topped with yellow mustard, chopped white onions, bright green, and like green as the river in Chicago that they dye on St. Patrick's Day, that green, like neon green, bright green sweet pickle relish, a dill pickle spear, and tomato slices or wedges. And then also pickled peppers and a dash of celery salt. This is the dog that's said to have been dragged through the garden due to its many vegetable toppings. And the method for cooking the dog itself depends on the vendor's preference, though most are often steamed or simmered. So that's a little bit about the Chicago-style dog. If you ever get over to the Cubs Stadium, you will get to experience the neon green relish in person. It's pretty intimidating to look at. It does not look edible at all. Moving along, another favorite snack, of baseball stadiums around the world is peanuts, of course. As I said earlier, buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jacks. So peanuts, which are also, I just sort of know this, a distinctly American crop, are very popular at games. Raw or roasted, shelled or unshelled, peanuts have been classics in the ballpark snacks section since the earliest days of baseball, but their history goes back much further. Spanish conquistadors exploring the New World were first introduced to peanuts in South America, most likely in Brazil or Peru. They took the plant back home to Europe, and it quickly spread to Africa and Asia. In the 1700s, slave traders brought the peanuts back across the Atlantic, using it as a cheap food source for African captives. A handful of commercial farms in the southern United States started growing peanuts in the 1800s, mainly for oil and livestock fodder. As a food, it was regarded as something only poor people ate, and that all changed during the Civil War, when soldiers on both sides recognized that peanuts' value as a tasty, convenient, and inexpensive snack. After the war, demand increased rapidly as vendors began selling freshly roasted peanuts on street corners, at circuses, and of course at baseball games. In the early 1900s, George Washington Carver, a renowned botanist who was the son of a slave, began researching peanuts, hoping to find an alternative cash crop that could lessen the South's dependence on cottons. His work led to widespread peanut cultivation across the country, especially in the South, and earned him a reputation as the father of the American peanut industry. Did you know? Peanuts aren't really nuts at all. They're actually part of the legume family. And that means they're more closely related to peas and lentils than a cashew or a pecan. Peanut butter was invented in 1890 by a St. Louis doctor who prescribed it for patients with digestive problems. Americans eat more than 600 million pounds of peanuts and about 700 million pounds of peanut butter each year, according to the National Peanut Board. And some major league parks now designate special peanut-free games to accommodate fans with severe peanut allergies who may have reactions to the dust in the air. That seems really considerate. And March is National Peanut Month. I didn't know that. It's also Women's History Month. What a confluence of things. And now let's talk a little bit about Cracker Jacks. This is pretty fascinating to me. Native Americans first started popping corn thousands of years ago, and by 1893, popcorn makers Frederick and Louis Rookheim were determined to give the puff kernel a new twist. The two brothers threw molasses and peanuts into the mix and unveiled the sweet and salty treat at the 1893 World's Fair in Chicago. A few years later, they developed a special formula to keep the ingredients from sticking together, and that remains a secret to this day. A satisfied taster pronounced the new and improved snack a Cracker Jack, using a slang term of the era that roughly translates to awesome. The Rookheims trademarked the expression, and a decade later, Jack Norworth and Albert von Tilsner immortalized it in a classic song, Take Me Out to the Ball Game. Amazingly, it would be years before the two songwriters saw an actual game of baseball. Did you know? In 2009, Boston Steinway Park sold roughly 1,000 bags of Cracker Jacks per game. And during World War II, the Cracker Jack Company produced thousands of non-perishable, ready-to-eat meals known as K-rations that troops could easily carry in store. High-calorie foods were crammed into wax paper containers about the size of a regular Cracker Jack box. The first Cracker Jack box with a toy surprise appeared in 1912, and since then, more than 23 billion trinkets, cards, and other prizes have been given out. Some vintage Cracker Jack prizes are valued at more than $7,000. And July 5th is Cracker Jack Day, which kind of goes nicely with July 4th being the national day of high-selling hot dog records, don't you think? Anyway, I hope you enjoyed that. That was a little bit of a history of some of the more important things that happened at baseball games, all the snacking. Speaking of snacking, every year, if you're a Mets fan like I am, every year Citi Field sort of ups their game. I admit I'm a Mets fan, I'm not a Yankees fan, but there's a huge difference between the two stadiums anyway. There's just so many options at Citi Field, so even if you're not really that invested in baseball, you're still going to have a fun time eating, because there's so many different types of foods, and a lot of it's really great. And they have things like Momofuku fried chicken, Shake Shack, Pat LaFrieda steak. One of my favorite things is the Arancini Bros. They have these little rice balls that they serve you in an egg carton. It's kind of perfect. And of course, soft serve. But this year, like all years, they're going to have all new, brand new concessions that you can look forward to when you visit. And the home opener is actually next Thursday, April 4th, or this coming Thursday. So I'm excited to get back to Citi Field Eat, and I will play you a little clip about what's new this year at this stadium. Let's hear from that.
Fans, the days of scoring games at the ballpark are long gone, which means you can say RIP to the 6-4-3 and hello to the FOODIE.
They come in with a game plan on where they're going to eat and how much time they have to do that, where they're going to hit first, and then get back to the seat and watch baseball.
Patrick Schaefer is the executive chef at Citi Field, where they've partnered with some New York food icons to bring the best food from around the city to the game. Whether it's a sandwich from Mama's of Corona, pizza from Emmy Squared, or the classic filet mignon sandwich from Pat LaFrieda's, there's something for everyone.
You can try things from all of, from Brooklyn, from Queens, from Manhattan, from, you know, everywhere.
And if you need to walk off some of the food in between innings, you can always stroll around the stadium to the Mets Hall of Fame, where this year they're celebrating the 50th anniversary of the 69 World Series champs.
Everything in this case is from the 69 season.
Lorraine Hamilton is the executive director of broadcasting and events for the Mets. She curated the exhibit of memorabilia from the Miracle Mets.
This is a Christmas card that Casey Stengel sent to Joe Pignatano, predicting that 69 would be the greatest season ever.
Stengel would prove to be Nostradamus, thanks in part to Ron Swoboda and the catch in Game 4 of the World Series that year.
And I thought, gosh, wouldn't it be great to have that glove in the museum this year? And I called Ron up and he said, I've got it. I'll send it to you.
The Mets will host a weekend-long celebration for the team starting June 28th. The events include a reunion for the 69 champs, a celebration that deserves a feast. Judging by the looks of things, they're ready. Reporting from Citi Field, Joe Messiri, PIX 11 News.
All right, so that's a little bit about what's going to be happening at Citi Field this year. I am very excited to get back there, buy a hot dog, have a beer, hear the crowd cheering. It's such a, I don't even know how to explain it. Someone said, one of my friends said they were so relieved that their favorite, like, no background noise was on. And baseball, it's not necessarily a background noise to me. And I understand she didn't mean that literally either. But it is, there's something so comforting in just knowing that a game's going to be on and you can listen to it. I'm sure many of you out there know there is a huge tie between the sport and radio. So it's another reason I love it. It's very easy to listen to. If you don't have your local SNY channel or whatever the Yankees channel is. Just feel like soothed and comforted. I'm going to play a really beautiful essay from Bart A. Giamatti in a little moment here about why he loved the game and he was the commissioner of baseball before he passed away very early. But right now, let's talk more about hot dogs, because there are distinctive styles for different cities and different regions, much like barbecue. So let's delve in, because I'm excited. I mean, New York City is often associated with hot dog, and I don't even know if I myself have a specific idea of whatever our type of hot dog is here. So I'm going to find out and also tell you about some other ones right now. And then we'll hear from Bart Giamatti, this beautiful essay, The Green Fields of the Mind. Americans eat billions of hot dogs a year in restaurants, at street carts, ballparks, and backyard barbecues. Hot dogs are everywhere, but depending on where you purchase your hot dog, your toppings may differ radically. Here's a short guide on what to expect when you buy your hot dog away from home. And this is literally from hot-dog.org, so it's got to be the right source, right? New York City. New Yorkers eat more hot dogs than any other group in the country, from downtown Manhattan to Coney Island. When you buy your hot dog in the Big Apple, it will come served with steamed onions and a pale, deli-style yellow mustard. In Chicago, the possible antithesis to New York dogs, Chicago dogs are layered with yellow mustard, dark green relish, chopped raw onions, pickle spears, sport peppers, tomato slices, and topped with a dash of celery salt, and served in a poppy seed bun. Atlanta in the South, buying a hot dog at Turner Field, home of the Atlanta Braves, or elsewhere in Atlanta in the South, you will find your hot dog topped with coleslaw and perhaps some delicious Vidalia onions. Sounds really good. In Kansas City, get the mints out. You'll need them. This hot dog is in KC, is served with sauerkraut and melted Swiss cheese on a sesame seed bun. It sounds delicious as well. The rookie dog is served at Coors Field. The Rocky Dog, served at Coors Field, the home of the Colorado Rockies, is a foot-long dog with grilled peppers, kraut, and onions. At Fenway, we have another special dog, served at none other than Fenway Park, is the only dog to eat while watching the Red Sox. It's boiled and grilled and served in a New England-style bun with mustard and relish. New England dogs can be found also topped with Boston baked beans. I'm not sure I'm into that. The Sonoran Dog, this is a Southwestern favorite, features grilled bacon wrapped hot dogs on a sturdy bun, pinto beans, grilled onions, green peppers, chopped fresh tomatoes, relish, tomatillo, jalapeno salsa, mayonnaise, mustard, and shredded cheese. That is intense, but it does sound kind of delicious. in Texas, the chili cheese and jalapeno dog is the favorite item at Minute Maid Park in Houston. Michigan Coney Island dog, aka Michigan Coney, is the favorite of Michiganders, featuring a meaty chili sauce on top of a hot dog with mustard and onions. The West Virginia dog features chili, mustard, and coleslaw atop a wiener on a steamed bun. The New Jersey dog, a variety of hot dog styles can be found in Jersey. One of the most unique is the Italian dog. It's a dog in a thick pizza bread topped with onions, peppers, and deep-fried potatoes. That sounds very intense. Philadelphia dog is a classic. Philadelphia is one of the most interesting ones you can find. It features the brotherly love of an all-beef hot dog with a fish cake inside the bun as well. It is often topped with a sweet vinegary slaw and a spicy mustard. The Cleveland Polish boy is a kielbasa or hot dog served on a bun layered with french fries, a layer of sweet southern-style barbecue sauce or hot sauce, and a layer of coleslaw. It is commonly found in carts around town, at Indians games, and elsewhere in the city. You can also top your hot dog with stadium mustard, a type of brown mustard with a similar flavor to a spicy Dijon. The Cincinnati Coney, home of the famous, Cincinnati's home of famous chili, is also home of some delicious chili dogs. They are topped with Cincinnati-style chili and usually also feature a heaping mound of grated cheese. In D.C., the nation's capital, is where you'll find the Half Smoke, a half-pork, half-beef sausage that is like a hot dog but with more coarsely ground meat and a little extra spice. A classic Half Smoke is topped with chili, mustard, onions, and you can find them in hot dog joints all around the city as well as at the Nationals Park. In California, there are many different hot dog varieties sold. The one that is most unique is a bacon-wrapped dog with grilled onions and peppers. These are popular in Los Angeles and San Francisco, and I believe Dodgers have what they call a Dodger dog. And Seattle offers a topping twist not found in many places around the country, cream cheese. The hot dogs are split in half before and grilled before putting on a toasted bun and topped with grilled onions. Sriracha sauce and jalapenos are also popular. And finally, from Alaska, the Alaska dog is commonly called a reindeer hot dog or sausage, but it isn't made from reindeer meat. Instead, the meat is typically caribou, and the hot dog is served on a steam bun with grilled onions, and sometimes the onions are sauteed in Coca-Cola. So that is extremely unique. I had no idea there were so many options out there. If you've ever been to Criff Dog here in Brooklyn, they also have very many wild types of hot dogs and lots of bacon-grilled ones, or bacon-wrapped ones, so you should check that out if you listen to this and are suddenly craving a hot dog. Now we're going to hear from Bart A. Giamatti, who is the commissioner of baseball, with this beautiful essay that I listen to every year at the end of the season and the beginning of the season. It's one of my favorite things. It's just super beautiful, and it's great to hear him read it in his own voice. So I hope you'll enjoy. This is Reciprocity Radio here on Radio Free Brooklyn. Thanks so much for listening, and thank you for tuning in. I'll be right back after this short break.
But Bart, of course, is a Renaissance man, and that means that he is also a Red Sox fan. He wrote a classic piece, actually, one of his great pieces, called The Green Fields of the Mind. Please welcome him back, Commissioner Bart Giamatti.
Little piece was originally written one afternoon as the class notes for the class of 1960 in Yale College. I was the class secretary. I had absolutely nothing to say about my classmates. I wrote what you're about to hear. It was properly and immediately rejected by the Yale Alumni Magazine on the grounds that it was completely irrelevant to the purpose of the class notes. I accepted the judgment cheerfully, and then when unaccountably 2 months later I became president, the Alumni Magazine reprinted it. Remarkable. But not as class notes. It breaks your heart. It is designed to break your heart. The game begins in the spring when everything else begins again, and it blossoms in the summer, filling the afternoons and evenings, and then as soon as the chill rains come, it stops and leaves you to face the fall alone. You count on it, rely on it to buffer the passage of time, to keep the memory of sunshine and high skies alive, and then, just when the days are all twilight, when you need it most, it stops. Today, October 2nd, a Sunday of rain and broken branches and leaf-clogged drains and slick streets, it stopped, and summer was gone. Somehow the summer seemed to slip by faster this time. Maybe it wasn't this summer, but all the summers that in this, my 40th summer, slipped by so fast. There comes a time when every summer will have something of autumn in it. Whatever the reason, it seemed to me that I was investing more and more in baseball, making the game do more of the work that keeps time fat and slow and lazy. I was counting on the game's deep patterns, three strikes, three outs, three times, three innings, and its deepest impulse to go out and back, to leave and to return home, to set the order of the day and to organize the daylight. I wrote a few things this past summer, the summer that did not last. Nothing grand, but some things. And yet, that work was just camouflage. The real activity was done with the radio, not the all-seeing, all-falsifying television. And was the playing of the game in the only place it will last? The enclosed green field of the mind. There in that warm, bright place, what the old poet called mutability, does not so quickly come. But out here, on Sunday, October 2nd, when it rains all day, Dame Mutability never loses. She was in the crowd at Fenway yesterday, a gray day full of bluster and contradiction. When the Red Sox came up in the last of the ninth, trailing Baltimore 8-5, well, the Yankees, rain delayed against Detroit, needing only to win one or have Boston lose one to win it all, sat in New York washing down cold cuts with beer and watching the Boston game. Boston had won two, the Yankees had lost two, and suddenly it seemed as if the whole season might go to the last day or beyond, except here was Boston losing 8-5, while New York sat in its family room and put up its feet. Lynn, both ankles hurting now as they had in July, hits a single down the right field line. The crowd stirs. It's on its feet. Hobson, third baseman, former Bear Bryant quarterback, strong, quiet, over 100 RBIs, goes for three breaking balls and is out. The goddess smiles and encourages her agent, a canny journeyman named Nelson Bryles. Now comes the pinch hitter, Bernie Carbo, one-time Rookie of the Year, erratic, quick, a shade too handsome, so laid back he's always in his soul, stretched out in the tall grass, one arm under his head, watching the clouds and laughing. Now he looks over some low stuff unworthy of him, and then, uncoiling, sends one out. Straight on a rising line, over the center field wall, no cheap Fenway shot, but all of it, the physics as elegant as the arc the ball describes. New England is on its feet, roaring. The summer will not pass. Roaring, they recall the evening late and cold in 1975, the sixth game of the World Series, perhaps the greatest baseball game played in the last 50 years. When Carbo, loose and easy, had uncoiled to tie the game that Fisk would win. It is now 8-7, one out, and school will never start, rain will never come, sun will warm the back of your neck forever. Now Bailey, picked up from the National League recently, big arms, heavy gut experience, new to the league and the club, fouls off too, and then, checking, tentative, a big man off balance, he pops a soft liner to the first baseman. It is suddenly darker and later. And the announcer doing the game coast to coast, a New Yorker who works for a New York television station, sounds relieved. His little world, well lit, hot combed, split second timed, has no capacity to absorb this much gritty, grainy, contrary reality. Cox swings a bat, stretches his long arm, bends his back. The rookie from Pawtucket who broke in 2 weeks ago with a record six straight hits. The kid drafted ahead of Freddie Lynn. Rangy, smooth, cool. The count runs 2-2, and Cox swings. The ball beginning toward the mound, and then, in a jaunty, wayward dance, skips past Bryles, feinting to the right, skimming the last of the grass, finding the dirt, moving now like some small, purposeful marine creature negotiating the green deep, easily avoiding the jagged rock of second base and traveling steady and straight now out into the dark, silent recesses of center field. Well, the aisles are jammed, the places on its feet, the wrappers, the program, the Coke cups and peanut shells, the detritus of an afternoon, the anxieties, the things that have to be done tomorrow, the regrets about yesterday, the accumulation of a summer, all forgotten, while hope, the anchor, bites and takes hold, where a moment before it had seemed we would be swept out with the tide, rice is up. Rice, who Aaron had said was the only one he'd seen with the ability to break his records. Rice, the best clutch hitter on the club with the best slugging percentage in the league. Rice, so quick and strong, he once checked his swing halfway through and snapped the bat in two. Rice, the hammer of God, sent to scourge the Yankees. The sound was overwhelming. Fathers pounded their sons on the back. Cars pulled off the road. Households froze. New England exulted in its blessedness and roared its thanks for all good things, for Rice and for a summer stretching halfway through October. Briles threw, Rice swung, and it was over. One pitch, fly to center, and it stopped. Summer died in New England, and like rain sliding off a roof, the crowd slipped out of Fenway quickly, with only a steady murmur of concern for the drive ahead remaining of the roar. Dame Mutability had turned the seasons and translated hope to memory once again. And once again, she had used baseball, our best invention to stay change, to bring change on. That is why it breaks my heart, that game. Not because in New York they could win, because Boston lost, and that there's a rough justice and a reminder to the Yankees of how slight and fragile are the circumstances that exalt one group of human beings over another. It breaks my heart because it was meant to. Because it was meant to foster in me again the illusion that there was something abiding, some pattern and some impulse that could come together to make a reality that would resist the corrosion. And because after it had fostered again that most hungered for illusion, the game was meant to stop and betray precisely what it promised. Now, of course, there are those who learn after the first few times. They grow out of sports. And there are others who are born with the wisdom to know that nothing lasts. These are the truly tough among us, the ones who can live without illusion or without even the hope of illusion. But I am not that grown up or up to date. I am a simpler creature, tied to more primitive patterns and cycles. I need to think something lasts forever. And it might as well be that state of being that is a game. It might as well be that in a green field, in the sun. Thank you.
Excuse me. I got a little, like, choked up. That's one of my favorite essays of all time. Bart A.G. Money, The Green Fields of the Mind, on all of baseball and its hope and wonder and suspension and endlessness. As promised, I will now tell you a little bit more about the history of gum and the sports and baseball cards, which I don't know if you know. But at the Metropolitan Museum of Art here in New York, they are having they brought out some of their vintage baseball cards to show again. You can find the info on their website, obviously. I've seen it in years past, and it was nice to see that they brought it back out for the season. Pretty awesome. You should go check it out if you can. And now let's talk about baseball cards and gum. How baseball cards and gum became intertwined. And what it has to do with cigarettes. Nearly three decades later, the bubblegum in the pack of a 1989 Topps baseball card is unsurprisingly inedible. Now an off-pink color, it was probably a mistake to pop the stick into my mouth, but it could have been worse. It was essentially like chewing chalk, crunchy, dry, and with a cardboard taste. But if my memory is accurate, there wasn't much of a difference between now and what the gum actually tasted like in 1989. And now a little bit more about why is there gum in baseball card facts. The first baseball card was produced in the late 1860s by the New York-based sports company Peck & Snyder, featuring the 10 members of the Red Stocking Baseball Club of Cincinnati. The card was intended as a marketing gimmick for the equipment company. And as Dave Jameson describes in his book, Mint Condition or How Baseball Cards Became an American Obsession, save the knee-high socks and the team looked like a group of convicts. In the 1880s, baseball cards made their first appearance in a pack of cigarettes. Beyond marketing purposes, the cardboard cards pulled double duty. They also stiffened the flimsy cigarette packs. The cards often feature players with serious expressions looking manly and in very awkward poses. But baseball players weren't the only ones on these cards. Vaudeville actors and actresses, war heroes, and Native American tribe leaders in headdresses also graced the cardboard squares. In 1909, the American Tobacco Trust, a conglomerate of 16 different tobacco companies, put out the Legacy T206 set and a collection of over 520 cards that were hidden in cigarette packs across the country. Included in the set was the card of Honus Wagner, now known as the most valuable baseball card in history. It is the holy grail of baseball cards, and in October 2016, it sold for a record $3.12 million for a piece of cardboard. Even by the 1880s, state laws were being enacted to prohibit the sale of tobacco products to children, and by the end of World War I, most states had these regulations on the books, and some even had a minimum age of 21 before tobacco companies lobbied to decrease the age to 18 or even 16. It soon became increasingly clear that these trading cards and cigarette packs weren't of any particular appeal to adults, but they were to underage minors who were now supposedly barred from buying the actual product. Several players at the time spoke out that they didn't think it was appropriate that cards featuring their likeness, which were more often collected by kids, were sold among a product that was illegal for them to purchase. So along with this pushback, paper rationing during the war also contributed to the end of tobacco baseball cards. But with baseball cards now popular, several companies began including them in more kid-friendly food items. In the early 1930s, the Fleer Company, the creator of Double Bubble, which is that hideous pink gum that I was talking about earlier, and Gaudy Gum, competed with one another by selling baseball cards along with their gum. While the Fleer brand would actually survive into the 2000s as a baseball card company, their cards at the time were considered cheap, flimsy, and ugly. Gaudy's gum cards, on the other hand, were carefully and artfully done, so much so that Lou Gehrig cards in the Mets collection, which it is. I've seen it. Besides the T206 set, the cards of the Gaudy collection are considered the most valuable ever produced. This might have something to do with their rarity. In the winter of 1962, the company was on the verge of bankruptcy and could barely keep their factory warm. According to Jameson's book, the company president ordered that their backlog of 1930s-era baseball cards would be thrown into the furnace as a cheap source of heat. The company officially went out of business only weeks later. Famed Topps baseball cards were introduced in 1951 and were accompanied by taffy rather than gum. This was a bad idea because the taffy picked up the flavor of the card's varnish. Said Sig Berger, the co-designer of the cards and the legendary baseball card figure, "You wouldn't dare put that taffy near your mouth. The 15-1 series was really a disaster." The next year, Topps switched over to gum. And for the next four decades, Topps, along with most other baseball card companies, included gum in their baseball card packs. But in 1991, they took the gum out because of serious collectors' complaints that the gum stained the cards. This made them worthless, and over the years, there have been several attempts to reintroduce gum to packs of baseball cards, but it has never stuck. At least for now, we just have to satisfy our cravings by eating stale gum from 1989. Now, I wouldn't recommend that you do that. Please don't. I think that's a bad idea. But, you know, you can imagine the taste. It's that chalky, powdery, not satisfying, not worth it in my opinion. I mentioned Big Lee Chew a little bit earlier, so we're going to talk about that now. This is from Thrillist, Things You Didn't Know About Big League Chew, which, as I explained before, is a gum that was sort of sold in the packaging resembling chewing tobacco. Looking back, this seems wildly inappropriate, but I loved it as a kid, so let's talk about that. Chocolate cigars and bubble gum that mimic chewing tobacco were some of the best and most innocent ways we got to pretend to be cool as kids. So here to help you reminisce about the glorious preteen years are 12 lesser-known facts about the baseball-inspired chewing gum, Big League Chew. Dip into a pack and soak up the nostalgia. Number 1, it's partially responsible for breaking a Guinness World Record. Back in 2014, 721 people came together at the Cal Ripken Babe Ruth World League Series and blew some very coordinated bubbles to win the record for most people blowing bubblegum simultaneously. The previous title was achieved with 544 people and was set in June 6, 2013 by the Lester B. Pearson School in Aurora, Ontario, Canada. A real-life baseball player invented this gum, inspired by the game that he loved and the players around him. Portland Mavericks ball player Rob Nelson first came up with the idea for Big League Chew in the summer of 1977. Almost 40 years later, Nelson continues to stand behind his creation and maintains full rights and creative control over the product. And you better bet that come Halloween, his door is the one to knock on. Number 3, it wasn't always pink. Nelson first developed a root beer and maple extract flavored Big League Chew so that it would be brown and truly mimic its inspiration, which is chewing tobacco. I really wanted it to be a fun alternative to chewing tobacco, Nelson shared with us. Wrigley loved his pitch, but told him to stick to regular pink bubblegum because it didn't want to be seen as condoning tobacco. It's actually Bubble Tape's cousin. Ron Rehm, the chemist and VP of Marketing and Corporate Development of Amaral Products, a division of Wrigley's between 1979 and 2004, invented the technology behind both bubblegums. Today he is the owner of MyBigLeeChew.com, a site where you can go and custom order your own pack of Big League Chew with your name on it. Rehm also recently produced a military-geared gum that is aimed to pack in enough caffeine to keep the troops going. Wow. Number 5, there have been some experimental flavors over the year, like Cherry Sparks, which was cherry with crushed lifesavers. But for the most part, Big League Chew sticks to the flavors it loves and knows best. Outta Here Original, which is a regular bubblegum flavor, and Grape, which is what owner Rob Nelson says tastes like Cabernet Franc. At moments, it also has featured watermelon and sour apple. Apparently, according to number 6 on this list, Utah loves shredded bubblegum. It's more popular there than any other state. Why? Your guess is as good as ours. Apparently, there are a handful of minor league baseball teams there, and Mormons love chewing gum in a pouch. Number 7, the company crushed it in its first year. It was 1980, and it did $18 million in sales. The following year, in 1981, the Wrigley family, the original manufacturers of Big League Chew, sold the Cubs for $22 million. Rob Nelson remembers calling his dad and saying, "Dad, the Wrigley family just replaced the Chicago Cubs with Big League Chew." To date, Big League Chew has sold over 800 million packages worldwide and counting. The first batch was made in a 15-year-old's kitchen. Todd Field attended Nelson's baseball camp in Portland and soon after became the Mavericks bat boy. Nelson didn't have a kitchen of his own, so he employed the Field's kitchen to test out the concept. Nelson also happened to be dating Field's older sister at the time. Todd Field has since gone on to become an actor and a 3-time Academy Award winning nominating filmmaker. Wow. It's homegrown after a detour to Mexico thanks to Wrigley's Big League Chew. It's once again made in the United States. As of 2010, Ford Gum and Machine Co. proudly shreds and packs Big League Chew in Akron, New York. Its use is the same machines that were used to produce the gum over 35 years ago, so each chew is truly like the original. A Shaq-sized pouch was created for Shaq. A jumbo-sized pouch that was 24 inches by 18 inches was custom-made for Shaquille O'Neal. It was over 15 times the size of regular Big League Chew. Somehow, though, when he holds the pouch, it seems like the right fit. Action Bronson is a big fan. The rapper and chef Bronson created the song last year for his web show, Fuck That's Delicious, where he gets to travel and dabble in some bits in the kitchen. Some of the lyrics included are, "I got the whole pack of Bigly Chew by the cheekbone." Number 12, final fact here, it's in Baseball Hall of Fame. Informally inducted in November of the past year, as part of the whole ballgame exhibit, Bigly Chew proudly sits on display, featured under baseball advertising sections with other advertisements. The new exhibit covers baseball history from the 1970s and onward. Be sure to check it out next time you visit Cooperstown. So that's some facts about Bigly Chew. I hope you enjoyed today's episode about the relationship between baseball and food. I know I had fun talking about it, and I'm going to have even more fun watching baseball until October. What a great way to start these warmer months. Truly can't express the happiness that I feel about it. This has been Reciprocity Radio here on Radio Free Brooklyn. Thanks so much for listening. Just so you know, Radio Free Brooklyn is a volunteer-based, community-oriented radio station. So if you like what you hear at any point listening to us, please consider donating. You can go to radiofreebrooklyn.org/donate. Your donations will help us stay on the air, will help us continue our programs and outreach, will help us keep doing really fun concerts and playing local bands and having all kinds of fun events. You can find out more about that, of course, on radiofreebrooklyn.org as well. So thank you so much for tuning in. I'm going to close out with a couple of little fun songs. I'm going to hear from Yellow Tango, which, if I'm being honest, is the reason I started to love baseball to begin with. I read their book, I think it's called Big Time Coming or Big Day Coming, and it started out with the history of the Elysian Fields, which are located in New Jersey, near the Maxwell House, which is, they used to play at this venue called Maxwell's that is closed since, blah, 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 blah. I started reading about a band and ended up getting really invested in the history of baseball, so I gotta play them. They're huge Mets fans. And I'm signing out. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'll be back next week. I'm here every week on Sunday at 5, unless I'm at a baseball game, in which case maybe you'll hear a rebroadcast of this show. Thank you for tuning in to Radio Free Brooklyn. See you next week.
1, 2, 3, 4. Meet the Mets, meet the Mets. Step right up and greet the Mets. Spring your kitties, spring your wife. Guaranteed to have the time of your life, because the Mets are really stocking the ball, knocking those home runs right over the wall. East side, west side, everybody's coming down to meet the METS Mets of New York Town. Solo! Greet the Mets, bring your kitties, bring your wife. You're guaranteed to have the time of your life, because the Mets are really sucking the ball. They're knocking those home runs right over the wall. East side, west side, everybody's coming down to meet the METS Mets of New York. Meet the Mets, meet the Mets. Step right up and greet the Mets. Spring your kitties, spring your wife. Guaranteed to have the time of your life, because the Mets are really stocking the ball, knocking those home runs right over the wall. East side, west side, everybody's coming down to meet the METS Mets of New York.